An API is a way for somebody, a company, a person, whoever's building something to connect with a service or platform or whoever the provider of that API is. And let me give a little bit more information there. So a platform or service can have a lot of things that it does. So it might have data that is really valuable for these external companies or developers or partners to want to do things with, or it might have functionality. So if you think about Twitter, you can have some different APIs or endpoints for creating tweets or for sending DMs or for uploading media. So there's a lot of that functionality that APIs make it possible for external folks to interact with or to do things with.
Welcome to Latinx in Power, a podcast hosted by Thaisa Fernandes.
Welcome to Latinx in Power. Today, we are talking with Juan Shishido. Juan is a product manager with a focus on APIs. He has experience in building and scale large products and improving developer experience. Juan holds a master's degree in information management and systems from the University of California, Berkeley. Juan is a product manager at TikTok and also a former Tweep. He worked at Twitter with me and it's where we met. I'm very excited with this conversation. I have been convincing Juan to be in this podcast for a long time. So welcome, Juan.
Thank you so much, Thaisa. I'm happy to be here. And yeah, thank you for having me.
In this episode, we will discuss building and scale large products with APIs and improving developer experience. Juan will share insights on his experience as a senior product manager, accelerating development speed and improving onboarding and user experience. Very, very cool topic. I'm very excited. And Juan, what does it mean to be a Latino for you?
Yeah, I love this question. So the things that come to mind for me are that we're similar, but unique. So of course, we have similar histories. Think about colonialism, slavery, indigenous populations, etc. We've got similar languages, music, and food. But I think all those things are, you know, really high level similarities. And when you go deeper, when you get to know and understand each culture, I think those elements that we all have in common are used and manifested in unique ways. And the way that each culture mixes them and makes them their own, I think that's a really special thing.
That's so cool. I never thought about that. I think I can totally relate to that because when we see in the surface, at least for me, being a Brazilian, not speaking Spanish, is, oh, we don't have that much in common. But I think when I got to know a lot of other folks from Latin America, I was like, oh my God, we are so similar. So I got to understand more. Yeah, I really like your view.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's great. And I think to your point also, thinking about language and slang and other things that I did not know about, those are also things that have been really cool for me to experience and learn as I've talked to more people, learned about different cultures or communities that speak Spanish. And so that's been really cool for me to see those kind of similarities and then the uniqueness that we have within each of our respective groups as well.
Really cool. How do you feel connected with your Peruvian side and Latin America in general?
Yeah, I think I've had a complicated history with this. So I grew up in Miami. And at the time, at least where I lived, the predominant Latin American culture was Cuban. And my stepdad was Cuban. And so I had a lot of those influences. And I didn't really think about or connect with the Peruvian side that much, I think, because of what I just mentioned, but then also societal factors and things that I'd picked up and internalized about maybe what it means to be indigenous and to not be, you know, kind of more European. And so I think, you know, a lot of folks who have experiences and families and people that they've grown up with who, you know, hold these things and make these comments where you kind of just see and kind of feel what is maybe more valuable and not can relate to what I'm saying. So I held a lot of those things in myself. And it wasn't until later, probably just a few years ago while I was at Twitter, that I learned to accept that a lot more, that side of me. And not just because it's Peruvian or whatever, but me being more open and accepting of who I am. Because at Twitter, I used to see a lot of people being proud of the places that they were from, the experiences that they had, and just me realizing that all of those things that we are and the experiences that we've had just kind of make us, you know, who we are today. So that helped me a lot.
That's so cool. We have the Japanese side and also the Peruvian side. And yeah, that's really interesting how sometimes it depends on where we are and how we see the world that might also change. And one thing that have been learning from a lot of other Latinx that I interview, a lot of us have this process of like assimilating as well. And then maybe after some time, we feel more, I don't know, maybe comfortable sharing our heritage. And I don't know, like, for example, I talked with some people that they were like, oh, I used to go to the Latino store to buy food with my parents and I hate it. And now I'm so proud of our food and I love it. That's incredible.
Absolutely. Like I had that same kind of experience growing up. And I think even like speaking the language, like I would always lean toward English, but now I'm super happy that I learned Spanish at home and then I'm able to speak and communicate with other people. And when I travel, obviously it helps a ton. And for learning other languages, like even Portuguese and, you know, Thaisa knows that I really love Brazil and Brazilian things. Like it's easier to make those connections. And I think the point about the Japanese side. So when I lived in Miami, it was predominantly, you know, people from Latin America who lived there. So that was, you know, to your point, some of the like identity that I picked up, even if it wasn't my own of like Peruvian, it was maybe like a mix of things. And so I didn't really connect with the Japanese side at all until I moved to California, where I'm like, okay, now there's a bigger population. Now I'm understanding more about food and some of the history and stuff like that. And maybe some of it is also from being older and just wanting to learn more about ourselves. But I definitely had that experience where the place that I lived kind of influenced the way that I saw myself. So definitely agree with that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And another topic that I love to talk more is product management and API. And how did you first become interested in product management and API design?
Yeah, so I kind of stumbled upon it in a way. When I started at Twitter, I was working on an API team, but I was on an external facing engineering team. So we would help companies, which we called partners, we would help them integrate and build solutions for end users with the APIs that we provided. So I had a really good connection with those customers, those like developers and partners that we were really working with. And because I hadn't worked at a tech company before, because I hadn't really worked with APIs before, those first few years at Twitter, I was really just kind of like in the weeds of wanting to gain the knowledge that I felt like I needed to be successful. And so I wasn't really thinking long term, but I was doing really well, like in my view, doing really well at the tasks and the responsibilities that I had. And so one day, our product manager, Justin, he asked me during lunch, like, hey, what do you like about, you know, this role that you're currently in? And because I was in this mode of just really trying to work well within the capacity that I had and with the responsibilities that I had, I wasn't really thinking long term. But I'm super glad that he asked that question because I like reflected on what I had done and what I liked. And what it always came back to for me was helping customers. So whatever way that I could, whatever capacity and ability that I had to do that, that's what I really enjoyed. So the early years of the role that I was in was really focused on support. So even just helping to answer questions or to unblock a customer felt really good. And as I kind of progressed, I started doing more on API design and more on other things that would help our customers use our products much more easily. So, you know, having that focus on customers, like during that lunch, Justin let me know that that's a really important aspect to being a product manager. And it's something that I hadn't considered, but that thought stuck with me. And over time, I kind of leaned more in that direction. And then I had an opportunity at Twitter to, you know, switch into that role. And that's how I got to where I am today.
That's incredible. I love when we have people supporting us or even like just sparkling the idea and hi, Justin. And I think this is another insight for folks who are listening to us that it's very interesting to switch to product management. It might be more natural in the same company that you already are. And it's great to have people supporting you.
Absolutely. I think like if I would have tried starting as a product manager at a separate company, I think that would have been a lot more difficult. So it definitely helped having the context on the product, on the customers, on the goals and things that we already had going on, because those were things that I didn't have to learn and that I could just focus on some of the other aspects of product management, which I had experience in. So for me, I think that really made it a lot easier of a transition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And how do you balance the needs of different stakeholders when building a product?
Yeah, I think here, and I'm sure other folks have said this and have thoughts as well, I don't think there's a formula or a perfect way to do this. But the way that I try to approach it is thinking a lot about the goals that we have, that we've set. So typically that would or maybe should come from leadership. And then within each pillar or org or team, you kind of understand what are the things that I can do or that our team can do in order to help, move those goals or move the metrics that we have associated with those goals in the right direction. And so super high level, the way that I think about it is as we're making decisions on things to do, just always going back to those goals and objectives that we have to say, is this thing that we're doing moving us, toward where we want to go, toward that end state that we want to be in? And of course, there's going to be cases where things come up, like a bug or some outage or something, where you have to shift your attention and priorities to work on that. And that's always going to happen. But also, if it's happening too much, then that's a conversation that you should have with like your team and your EM and other folks to see how can we either help mitigate that or help make sure that we stay focused on, our broader goals and the things that we want to do. And I think one more thing that I want to add here, because a lot of what I just mentioned was focused on the goals and the objectives that we have, but I think the stakeholder piece is super important as well. And I think a very important part about the role is making sure that as a product manager, you're always making space for yourself and for others that you work with to be able to listen and to have conversations and to understand what's going on, because all the folks that you work with have a different perspective on the customer, like what they're trying to do, their experiences, and all of those stories, all of those insights help us kind of piece things together much more clearly and give us like a better view of our customers and what we're trying to do. And sometimes you can get really important insights from those conversations where you can dig further to understand things better and possibly, go in a different direction and adjust what you're doing. So always make sure to listen to your stakeholders as well.
That's a really good advice. I feel, especially working with product management, you are working with complex problems and a lot of times with things that it was never done before, and tie those conversations to goals, to metrics, to numbers. It makes the conversation a lot more tangible and a lot of times also like bring the team or even yourself to earth, linking to those goals that your team is working towards, and also having a space where people can have those difficult conversations, also disagree. I think it's very, very important. I really like your insights.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree, absolutely. Having that space and the alignment piece is another one that's really important. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit.
Awesome. And we are talking about APIs. And before we go to the next question, what is an API, Juan?
Yeah, this is an awesome question. So an API is a way for somebody, a company, a person, whoever is building something, to connect with a like service or platform or whoever the provider of that API is. And let me give a little bit more information there. So a platform or service can have a lot of things that it does. So it might have data that is really valuable for these external companies or developers or partners to want to do things with, or it might have functionality. So if you think about Twitter, you can have some different APIs or endpoints for creating tweets or for sending DMs or for uploading media. So there's a lot of that functionality that APIs make it possible for external folks to like interact with or to do things with. So again, it could be related to data or reporting or analytics, or it could be relating to creating things like tweets or posting on TikTok or, you know, DMs or any of these sort of things, or creating campaigns if you work within ads. So the APIs basically allow companies and developers and folks to connect with the platform or service in a more programmatic way.
Incredible. How do I approach designing APIs that are scalable, flexible, and easy to use?
Yeah, this is a great question. I've got a lot of thoughts here, and I'm glad that I'm going to say this here so that I can go back and kind of like write this out, because I've been wanting to write this somewhere and just kind of, you know, put my thoughts on paper or on somewhere on the internet. But the first thing that I would recommend, or the first thing that I try to do, is to work backward. And so I learned this from an engineer that I was working with at Twitter, and it was such a great insight to me that it really shaped the way that I thought about product development and the way that we do things specifically like within APIs. So the kind of steps that I think about are, first, to understand the experience that you want to create for end users. So this is like a consumer, somebody who's doing something with like a software. So not the developer, not the partner. So whoever that end user is going to be. So understand what you want to create or what experience you want to have those end users have. And then after that, once you know what that is, then think about creating an API or designing an API that makes it easy to create that experience. And I think one other part that's important when you're designing APIs, and this is something that I think is really important to me, is to make sure you put as little work on your customer. So these now are like the developers or whoever's using your APIs, put as little work on them as possible. Like the platform, the service should do as much of that heavy lifting as possible. That's a strong view that I hold. And then third, so once you understand that experience for end users, once you've designed the API, now you can start talking about like the schema and the database and all the things that you need internally, like services, et cetera, to be able to build and enable those APIs to be created. And I think too often what I've seen in the past is we start with the schema, like with the database, you know, what fields do we need, what columns, et cetera. But that really then makes it difficult to go to reach that end user, right? It makes it difficult to build the APIs that we need. And kind of in the worst case, your external APIs might reflect your internal schema. And that's not necessarily the best way for somebody to interact with your platform or service. So that's the first kind of set of maybe principles or thinking that I have around designing APIs. Next is consistency. So I think there's general things that, you know, maybe come to mind around naming. You know, you want to make sure you name things in a consistent way. Formatting as well, times and, you know, date timestamps and all those things kind of come to mind here. But I think importantly, also, you have patterns, right? Like what kind of patterns are you creating across the different endpoints or APIs that you have? And then what structures are you returning in the API response? Like all of those things should be consistent so that when somebody learns how to use one of your APIs, they then intuitively know how to use another one because you have those consistent patterns.
Incredible. I'm loving this conversation. I think for folks who want to get into API or want to learn more, take notes. This is very, very, very important. And one thing, we have been talking, and I think also considering the state of the economy right now, we have a lot of layoffs. We know that the interview process is getting more and more competitive. So I want to talk more about that. And Juan, can you share any lessons you have learned or mistakes you have made when you were transitioning to product management or maybe doing the interview process?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that was really, really important to me was, and I kind of mentioned it in from the previous question, was to focus on those end users. And so I think my team started making great progress in doing that. And I think when you understand what that end user needs, then, as I said before, you work backward to see like, okay, what APIs can I create so that the partners or the developers can enable those outcomes or those experiences for those end users? Then there's so much more alignment with what you're trying to do, and it makes it much easier to reach those goals that we talked about before. I've seen a lot of experiences, you know, I've had them myself and then heard from others as well, where, you know, the platform or whoever the API provider is has these things that these goals that they have, but it's not often connected to that end user. Like, even though the goal might be stated for, you know, increase the number of whatever it is that they're focused on, there's not that connection that I've seen to like, how do you get them there? How do you empower those developers to do that? And so there's a lot of things that can impact that, like rate limits, which I know we haven't talked about, but something related to APIs or authentication and things that, if you really understand as the API provider, if you really understand how those end users are interacting with the software, then you might make different decisions around those rate limits or authentication or how you organize your APIs in general. And I think on that point around organization, and this is also something that I learned while at Twitter, was it's important to have a style guide or some principles that you have around how you approach designing. And since I just mentioned organization, that came to mind, and I have three things that I want to share that's related to design, but also related to like lessons learned that I had while working at my previous role. And that's like, should you create a new API or add to an existing one? And so three kind of things that I think about there are, number one, what is the customer's like mental model, or what are their expectations around what that thing that you're trying to create should look like? Sometimes that comes from competitors. They already have like an idea of what that looks like. Sometimes that just comes from, you know, their own experiences elsewhere or related, you know, products or services that they've used. But that mental model is important to be aware of, because if you kind of stray too much away from that, it's going to cause the developer, the partner, the person who's using your API to have to think a lot more when they're using your product. So that mental model is really important. The second thing that I think about is reusability. So the thing that you're creating, is it something that you expect your customers, either the developers or those end users, to reuse? And so media is a good example here. Sometimes, you know, images or videos or GIFs are just used once, but sometimes the end user wants to use those multiple times in different places. And so that could be a good indication of whether you build a new set of endpoints, like a new API resource, we call it, or not. So depending on the answer to that. And then the third is around usability, where once you understand how the developer is going to use something and what they want to show, that'll determine what you include in your API response. So for example, if somebody wants to do something with media, like render that media, you want to return all the information that they need in the API response, rather than just having like an ID to the media where they would then have to make another API request to pull that down. So just thinking about that usability piece is also really important.
Incredible. Really, really good advice. And do you have any other insight to share thinking about the interview process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just went through that, you know, a few weeks and months ago. And I think two main things that I want to say is, don't get discouraged. I think that's the first thing. I have a strong belief that how, not perception, but the mindset that we have when going into things like really kind of affects our outcomes, and not just for interviewing, but I think for in life in general. So try not to let disappointments that we're all going to face, that I faced, you know, many, many times, try to not let those things get you down. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't feel sad. Of course, we're going to feel sad and that's always okay. But try to the best of your ability to say, all right, let me try to learn from that experience so I can get better next time, and keep believing in yourself. Because as you progress, as you have more experience, you're going to get better at that. And then the second point is that a lot of the interview processes are super different. So, you know, you might expect something at company A and, you know, you did really well. And then you take the same approach to company B and they're just maybe looking for different things, or they're just maybe they have a different process and approach. And so we can't predict that. And so that'll be a thing that you maybe face. But just know that, like, sometimes companies are looking for something super specific, and that does not at all reflect on you or your abilities or, you know, skill, intelligence, experience, any of those things. So yeah, just keep it positive and, you know, keep going, and you'll get where you want to be.
Love it. Love it. And yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. And I think, like, approaching this phase, maybe you got laid off and you're looking for the next challenge, just approach this phase as you do in a full time. You know, every day you need to work, you apply for jobs, you talk with people, you try to recharge and start again. And something will happen. It might take time, it might not, but just approach this maybe as a job. So don't get discouraged with the no's. Continue applying, continue talking with people, asking for referrals, and trying to be very strategic as well. I'm sure you'll find your next challenge.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that brought to mind is that have your support group. Like, that helped me a ton throughout this process, not only with practicing with interviews and, you know, having mock interviews and whatnot, but also just talking to people. So, you know, a few names that I want to mention here, like Cam, he helped me a ton, Sarah as well, and then Thaisa. Like, this was a great source of support for me in helping to keep me going throughout the process. So big thanks to them. And then, you know, for folks in the interview process, like, make sure you check in with your people as well.
Yes, absolutely. And in this podcast, we love to share stories, journeys, insights. I know you're a big reader, so I'm curious, which resource helped you in your journey that you wanted to highlight?
I don't know if I'm a big reader, but I've read a few books, and maybe
these
are ones that I just reference often. But outside of these, I've probably not read anything else. But anyway, I have a few books and they've really helped kind of shape how I think about product management. And so the first one is this book called Start at the End. And it's really interesting because it talks about understanding the ideal state that you want in the world. And the world here can be like your customers related to your product, et cetera. And then once you know that, identify two kind of things. So the author mentions promoting pressures, which are things that encourage somebody to take a particular action, and then inhibiting pressures, which prevent somebody from taking those actions. Once you know those, then the author mentions doing like intervention design. So what this is you create these interventions that change behavior. And so these are your products, right? These are the updates that you're making to your products, the features or new products in general that help users change the behavior that they have so that they get closer to that ideal state. So I really love that. And, you know, we kind of mentioned this before as well, is thinking about that end goal that you have and then kind of working backward a little bit to get you there. But I really like that part about identifying both the promoting pressures and the inhibiting pressures, because moving those and helping to increase promoting or decrease inhibiting can help you get closer to that goal. The second book that I have is one called Demand Side Sales. And this one, it left a big impression on me, where instead of building a product and then working to find customers, we should, rather than doing that, we should focus and deeply understand our customers' problems, or what the author calls their struggles, and then build products that help them to make progress on the journeys that they're on. So you understand what customers are trying to achieve, and then you help them achieve it. And so when I think about that, it's no longer becomes, oh, hey, I have this thing you should try out. It becomes a conversation, you know, when you're trying to get somebody to like adopt or use your product, it becomes a conversation of, oh, I noticed that this thing is really difficult to do. This thing is really hard. I would like to, you know, show you something that I've tried or that I use or that I know or that I've worked on that helps with that specific problem or challenge. And that just kind of changes the person's mindset who is thinking about making that decision to work with you. And I really like that the author mentions that this struggle is where those opportunities exist for, you know, products or businesses, et cetera. And the third book is one called The Mom Test, which is really great in helping you think about how to ask questions when you're talking to customers so that you don't get just compliments and fluff and, you know, even lies sometimes about your product or idea or direction that you're trying to go in. So something that I've done myself in the past is ask, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? But that's not a good way to frame questions because people don't want to hurt your feelings, right? In general. And so this book really helped me with understanding how to generate or create or list out my questions, how to phrase them to really kind of understand what the customer's, you know, problems are, what they care about, and also helps with understanding how big of a problem something is. Because somebody can say, oh yeah, I really hate thing X. But then when you dig further and you ask them, for example, oh, what have you done as a, like a workaround or whatever? If they're like, oh, well, I haven't done anything, that's a good sign to say, well, maybe that's not as big of a problem as they initially said. So I think those three books have been really helpful for me in my thinking as a product manager.
Incredible. We are going to link to the description of this episode, those three books. Juan, I want to thank you so much for your time. That was incredible. I'm going to leave the last minutes for you to share anything you want to share and also where people can find you. And I heard you have a LinkedIn now.
Yeah, I didn't have LinkedIn for a long time. I have one now. I don't know how long it'll be there, but you know, it's there for now. Thank you for having me on, Thaisa. This was great. And you've had amazing guests in the past. And I'm just, you know, honored to be part of that family as well. In terms of where people can find me, I don't know. I'm not super active. I am super online, but not in terms of posting, more in terms of consuming. I have Twitter. I'm on TikTok. I don't post anything. And yeah, if you want, you could just DM me on Twitter and then we could talk from there.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much.